Thank you, Brother Ray and Brother Dan. Good afternoon, brethren. What a privilege and a pleasure it is for us to be back in Jackson. Our first visit to this area was over 30 years ago, and we are delighted to be. I think I've been here since that 30 years ago, but it's been a few since we've had the privilege of being with you. And we just might note, with you, we certainly miss our dear brother Edgar and other friends from the Jackson class who have gone before us. We bring you the love and greetings of your brethren in the Connellsville, Pennsylvania Ecclesia, who voted to send their love with us to you. They love you, and they are here in spirit with us. Our theme text is taken from Leviticus 25:10. And ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you. And ye shall return every man unto his possession, ye shall return every man unto his family. What does jubilee mean? We believe that jubilee can be boiled down to one word. It's the word yobel. That's the Hebrew word. It means the blast of a horn. Specifically, it means the signal of the silver trumpets. Who had the silver trumpets in ancient Israel? Was it everyone? We find our answer in Numbers chapter 10, verses 2, 8, and 10, which we will read in part. Make thee two trumpets of silver, and the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow with the trumpets. Also in the day of your gladness ye shall blow with the trumpets. The day of gladness, of course, was the first day of Jubilee. What was the first day of Jubilee? It was the Day of Atonement for natural Israel. So it was the priests. The priests were the ones who announced the beginning of the Day of Jubilee, the Day of Atonement. But the priests were not the only ones blowing horns. We find in Leviticus 25:9, Then shalt thou cause trumpet to sound throughout all your land. Interestingly enough here, the trumpet is not the silver trumpets. It was not a metallic trumpet at all. This trumpet was a shofar, a curved horn, a cartilage horn, a ram's horn. Very different from the metallic horn that the priests blew. The priests, of course, did not blow the shofars, but rather the common people blew the shofars throughout the land. The priests blew the silver trumpets. They signaled the beginning. They knew when the beginning of Jubilee had occurred. But the priests did not go personally parading throughout the land blowing the silver trumpets. No, that's not how it worked. Rather, the people heard the silver trumpets. And they blew their horns, the ram's horns. And so there was this chain reaction throughout all the land. That's how the word spread. They didn't have newspapers in those days. They didn't have smartphones. What was the basic concept of Israel's Jubilee? Well, friends, it all boils down to one word. And the one word is the word return. That's the key word in Leviticus 25:10, return. It's the word, it's the Hebrew word, shub, S-H-U-B. And it means to restore. Restore from what? Well, every 50 years, the natural Israelites got themselves out of balance. They got themselves out of balance socially. They got themselves out of balance economically and financially. But during the Jubilee, the Israelites were to return to their former estate, return to their former liberties, and return to their former possessions. Every 50 years, the Israelites' freedoms were restored, and they were given rest from the burdens that had accumulated over the prior Sabbath cycle, Jubilee cycle. Now, a question we might ask ourselves at this point is, why are we talking about this? This is ancient history pertaining to one tiny little nation on earth. And it happened so long ago. What relevance does it have for us today? Why do we bother studying this subject? Paul gives us the answer in Hebrews 10:1. he says there in part, for the law having a shadow of good things to come. Jubilee was part of Israel's natural law. The Jubilee pictured the things, the good things to come. But Paul gets even more specific in Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, because there he talks about the significance of the Sabbath days, which were a part of natural Israel's law. In Colossians 2, 16 and 17, he says there in part, the Sabbath days are a shadow of things to come. How many different kinds of jubilees are there in the Bible? Now notice our question is not how many times that ancient Israel celebrated the jubilee, but how many different kinds of jubilees does the Bible speak of? Is there one? Is there 10? Is there 100? We suggest the answer is 2. The one is what we might call Moses' jubilee, or Moses' restitution. Leviticus chapter 25. This jubilee, this restitution, was limited to one little tiny nation on earth, the ancient nation of Israel, and it was only temporary. But the second kind of jubilee or restitution that the Bible speaks of, we might label as Peter's restitution, Peter's jubilee. Acts chapter 3, verses 19 to 21, which no doubt all of us here can quote by heart. It's the restitution of all things. This is the restitution that has global impact, and it's the restitution that will be permanent. Peter's restitution is much broader than Moses. But Jesus suggests that these two different kinds of jubilees are connected. They are vitally connected. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 18, Jesus says there in part, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Israel's law, we might think of it as a small-scale model of what the world will experience. Moses' restitution pictures Peter's restitution. So if we want to know more about Peter's restitution, we study Moses' restitution. In Acts chapter 3, Peter adds to what Jesus taught in Matthew 5:18. He says there that the beginning of global restitution, the restitution of all things, marks the date of our Lord's second advent. In verse 21, we're all familiar with that verse, the heavens must retain our Lord until the times of restitution of all things. And when the times of global restitution begin, our Lord must return, and return personally. Why? Because God sends him to take charge of this global restitution work. Now, we mentioned that Moses' restitution pictures Peter's. But how does it do that? How does the one picture the other? We suggest that it pictures it in two different ways. We're going to look at both of these. First of all, Moses' restitution pictures what will happen in Peter's restitution. And Moses' restitution pictures when Peter's restitution begins. Let's look at the what question first. How does Moses' restitution picture what will happen in Peter's? We suggest that there are five dimensions. Five dimensions. We should say there's at least five dimensions. We're going to talk about five dimensions today. Moses' restitution was not single-dimensional. Moses' restitution was five-dimensional. It was multi-dimensional. Let's take a look at each of these five. We're going to call the first dimension of Moses' restitution debts canceled. Debts canceled. In Leviticus chapter 25, verses 39 to 41, this idea of debt cancellation is implied. We read there in part, "If thy brother be waxen poor and be sold unto thee, thou shalt not compel him to serve as a bondservant, but as an hired servant. He shall serve thee unto the year of Jubilee, and then shall he depart from thee." You know, the ancient Israelites were like many people in the world today. The ancient Israelites fell sometimes very deeply into personal debt. And debt, of course, is a form of bondage, isn't it? Often incurred through no fault of their own, maybe through health issues or maybe other misfortunes, this debt would be incurred. But Jubilee provided debt relief. Today we call it bankruptcy. Back then, they called it debt relief. The debts were legally canceled. There was freedom from this debt bondage, was one of the dimensions of Moses' restitution. What about Peter's? Well, through no fault of their own, the world has gotten themselves into a debt that they can never repay. In Psalms chapter 51, verse 5, we read there in part, "In sin did my mother conceive me." Adam's children did not choose to sin. Oh yes, Adam disobeyed, but we know the results and the consequences of that. But Adam's children were born into sin. They inherited this sinful nature. Romans 5:12, "One man's sin and death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned." Jesus alludes to this unpayable debt that the world of mankind has gotten themselves into in the parable of the unforgiving servant in Matthew chapter 18, verse 24. But friends, Peter's Jubilee is going to fix this problem. Jesus pays the world's sin debt with his own life. And Adam and his children will then become legally debt-free. Let's look at a second dimension of Moses' restitution. We're going to call this one possessions restored. Possessions restored. This would pertain to land and perhaps even aspects or items of personal property as well. This is brought to our attention in Leviticus 25, verse 13, which we there read in part, "In the year of Jubilee ye shall return every man unto his possession." Now, one way a person could satisfy his debts was to liquidate his assets, to sell off his property, and use those proceeds to satisfy his debt obligations. But the sale really was only an assignment of a lease. Remember, absolute ownership of the land of Israel, Eretz Israel, was prohibited by God. God only leased the property to the Israelites. And so when they sold it, it really wasn't a sale. Technically, it was an assignment of the lease that they had. Leviticus 25:23, we find that absolute sale of the land was prohibited by God. But the point is, whether we look at it as a sale or assignment of a lease, which is kind of a technical difference, Moses' Jubilee ended the lease assignment, and the land was returned to the original lessee. What about Peter's Jubilee? Well, when Adam was created, he was endowed with certain wonderful possessions. And we read of these in Psalms, the 8th chapter, verses 4 through 6, which we read in part. "What is man that thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and crowned him with glory and honor, and madest to him to have dominion over the works of thy hands?" When Adam was created, he was made in God's mental image. He was endowed with this wonderful ability to think and to reason, and to create, and to remember. But also he was made in God's moral image. The law of love was inscribed in his heart. He was given dominion over the earth. He was given dominion over the lower creation, over the fish and the fowl and every living thing. And he was given a beautiful home, which we know as Eden, which was perfect in every way, which represented, which was kind of an icon or a microcosm of, you, if you will, of the entire earth, of what it would become in due time. But sin entered, and these possessions were lost to one degree or another. Man became insane. Man became selfish. He lost control of the earth. He lost his dominion, and he was evicted from the garden. Peter's jubilee witnesses the return of all these lost possessions. In Psalms chapter 90, verse 3, we there read in part, "Return, return, ye children of men." Return to a sane mind. Return to the mental image of God, the moral image of God. Return to a heart filled with the love of God. Return to the kingship of earth. Return to a paradise. Return to a perfect earthly home. Let's look at a third dimension of Moses' restitution. We're going to call this one personal liberty restored. We already read Leviticus 25, verses 39 to 41, which contains the thought of the personal liberty being restored. But if one fell into debt, as we read in these few verses, and he had to sell, actually, not only his possessions, but he had to sell his personal liberty to satisfy his debt obligations, he then became a slave. And during the time of Jubilee, or the year of Jubilee, he was set free. Some became so deeply indebted that they indeed had to sell themselves into servitude. They were forced to sell their own liberty to subsist. They became slaves. Not in the sense that we think of the slaves in our day, of back in the time of the Civil War, the indentured servant. No, these, God said, were to be treated as hired servants. But it was still a form of bondage. Maybe not as bad as what we think of in modern times of slavery, but it was still a form of servitude or bondage. But Moses' jubilee ended that form of bondage, and personal freedom was restored. What about Peter's jubilee? Well, man has been in the prison house of sin and death for over 6,000 years. He's been enslaved by every form of sin that you can conceive of. Disease, substance abuse, crime, addiction, the list is endless. He's been enslaved by every form of this, and try as he would, man has been completely helpless to extricate himself from this sin. Paul says it well in Romans 7:14 when he says that he was sold under sin. In other words, he was sold into this slavery. Peter's jubilee changes all of that. The slaves will be liberated from the prison house of death. We have the wonderful words of the prophet Isaiah in 61 verse 1, which no doubt all of us here can cite. "The Lord hath anointed me to preach the good tidings, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound." No more evil, no more sin, no more sickness, no more death, no more dying, no more tyranny, no more ignorance. Personal liberty restored. You know, we've heard about the freedom fighters around the world, certainly during World War II, those who liberated those from the terrible throes of the prison camps, the death camps. They were freedom fighters. But you know, the real freedom fighters are the Christ, head and body, complete. They are the great liberators that will take charge. In 1 Corinthians 15, verses 25 and 26, we read, "For he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet, and the last enemy that shall be destroyed is Adamic death." Let's look at a fourth dimension of Moses' restitution. We're going to call this one families restored. Families restored. We read of this in Leviticus 25, verses 10 and 41, which we'll read in part. Quite simply, "Ye shall return every man unto his family." In ancient Israel, indebtedness and servitude often led to the split up of families. Families were scattered as bankrupt Israelites went wherever they could to subsist until the next Jubilee year. And this separation oftentimes lasted for decades. But Moses' Jubilee ended the separation. Moses' Jubilee ended the estrangement. Imagine the joy when the separated ones that had been separated for decades had the opportunity of being reunited with their families. It indeed was quite a family reunion. What about Peter's jubilee? Well, over the past 6,000 years, Adam's family have become deeply estranged. Violence, hatred, deceit, inhumanity, fraud, mistreatment. Friends, the human race has become almost totally dysfunctional. Separation from each other, we call that horizontal separation, horizontal estrangement. But there's been also vertical estrangement, estrangement from God. Peter's jubilee changes all that. In Ephesians chapter 1, verse 10, we read that in the dispensation of the fullness of times, he might gather together in one all things in Christ, both which are in heaven and which are on earth, even in him. Friends, this will be a reunion. This will be a global reunion on every level. Man with man with God, animal with man, angels with man with earth. Friends, this will be a reunion of reunions on every conceivable level that you can think of. Let's look at a fifth dimension of Moses' restitution. We're going to call this one the land rested. In Leviticus chapter 25, verse 11, we read there in part, "Ye shall not sow, neither reap that which groweth of itself." Ancient Israel's Jubilee year was also a Sabbath. It was a Shabbat year. It was a land of rest. It was a year of rest for the land. No sowing, no cultivating, and no systematic harvesting. They were allowed to eat and pick and eat whatever grew spontaneously, as we read in verses 12 and 19, but there was no systematic harvesting permitted. Now, we know that letting land lie fallow is good agricultural management, because letting land lie fallow helps to restore the soil with vital nutrients like nitrogen and potassium and other things that are vital to the health of our soil. Well, let's consider what has happened to the earth on a global scale for the past 6,000 years. Well, after Adam's sin, God cursed the earth, as we read in Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. "Cursed is the ground for thy sake." Perfecting process that had started in Eden was halted. But worse, man actually reversed that process. He's heaped gross abuses upon the earth: pollution, natural resource mismanagement, scarred earth, dust bowls, air pollution, water pollution. Land abuse has been for man's benefit, but friends, that list is gone, goes on and on. But this land abuse has been for the benefit of man as part of the permission of evil. But Peter's rest is going to change all of that. In Isaiah chapter 35, which has already been mentioned from this platform today, in verses 6 and 7, we read there that the waters shall break out, the parched ground shall become a pool. Isn't that a refreshing thought? The parched ground shall become a pool. It becomes hydrated again, full of life. In Isaiah chapter 60, verse 13, we read, "And I will make the place of my," this is Jehovah speaking, I will make the place of my feet glorious. The abuses that have been heaped upon the earth will be stopped, and the effects will be reversed. It'll be Eden everywhere in due time. So Moses' jubilee was a Shabbat, a rest for the land. And Moses' jubilee of rest for the land pictures the true perfecting of the entire earth itself. But there's something more. There's something bigger pertaining to this idea of the land rest. The benefits of land rest in both jubilees go beyond just restoring the soil. Consider what happened in ancient Israel. Israel was a farming society. It was an agricultural society, as Brother Dan already mentioned. Now imagine what God said to them here. No farming for 2 years. God, with that statement, basically put the Israelites out of business for 2 years. 2 consecutive years. He basically suspended their economy, which was an agrarian economy. God said, don't worry. Trust me, I'll take care of you. In Leviticus chapter 25, verse 21, we read, then I will command my blessing upon you in the 6th year, and it shall bring forth fruit for 3 years. Well, if we apply this text to the 50-year Jubilee cycle, we're talking about the 48th year, the 49th year, the 50th, and the beginning of the 1st year of the following cycle. And so, God here in Leviticus 25, 21 is saying, in this 48th year harvest, when you conduct your harvest in the 48th year of this 50-year cycle, it's going to carry you through the 49th, the 50th, and it will carry you into the period where you have your harvest into the 1st year of the new cycle. Now, you can also live off of the land, whatever grows by itself. So the question becomes for us is how do we interpret this 3-year promise in Leviticus 25:21? There's two different ways to look at this verse, at least two ways. We're going to suggest two. The first way to look at it is that God was saying that the 48th year yielded 3 times more crop than normal. So in other words, if the Israelites normally throughout, you know, their normal year of farming would yield 50 bushels per acre of grain, that this verse would be saying, well, in this 48th year, I'm going to make sure that your yield becomes 150 bushels per acre, 3 times more food, so you can carry through the remaining 2 years. But there's a second suggestion on how we might look at this verse, and that is they didn't get 150 bushels per acre. Maybe they got some more, probably not 3 times more. But the idea of the second suggestion is that the people had to scale back. They had to live more frugally. They had to stretch. They had to conserve in order to make it through this period of time when they were not permitted to systematically farm. During this period, they would consume less. There would be less focus on the earthly. And inherently, there would be a greater focus on the spiritual. They would have to do a degree of fasting. And fasting has a spiritual benefit. Fasting stimulated and restored their faith and their trust in God. The 2-year land rest restored their spiritual relationship with God. More time for study, more time for worship, meditation, appreciation, particularly as they were having to go back and focus on the details of what they were supposed to do in the year of Jubilee and realizing that these regulations were the mind of God. And they had to get them back in their heads and do the things that they needed to do during that period, during that year. Giving the land a year off, Letting the land lie fallow for a year wasn't rare. In fact, it was quite common. Every 7th year from the time that Israel set foot in the land got a year off. Every 7 years. Not every 50th year. Oh, yes, it got that too. But every 7 years. But the Jubilee Sabbath was different because it was the second back-to-back Sabbath year. That's what was different about it. By declaring the Jubilee year a land Sabbath, we believe that God had much more in mind than just giving the land another year off. He had in mind to restore Israel's faith. He had in mind of restoring Israel's trust and their confidence in Him as their Father. Moses' Jubilee year restored the Israelites' land, and it restored them spiritually. So we would say that Moses' Jubilee restored their soil, and Moses' Jubilee restored their soul. What about the global situation? Well, Adam had great respect for God, at least prior to the time that he sinned and disobeyed. He looked up to God in all ways as an obedient creature or creation of God. But since the fall, the world has lost most of their personal veneration for God. Most of the world is in the grossest of darkness when it comes to God. They don't even know him. In Luke chapter 18, verse 8, we read, "When the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth?" This was what the Son of Man expected. The implication here is no, he would not find faith on the earth, or not much of it, when he came. This lack of veneration for God is the world's greatest loss. And Peter's jubilee is going to fix it. Psalms chapter 46, verse 10, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth." Peter's jubilee is going to restore mankind spiritually. Peter's jubilee is going to re-enthrone God in the hearts of men and women, all people. And friends, this, we submit, is the greatest dimension of Peter's jubilee. And it's pictured, it's contained in this concept of rest for the land. We mentioned a second way that Moses' jubilee pictures Peter's, and we said it gives us the when question. So let's look at the when. How does Moses' restitution picture when Peter's restitution will happen? For this part of our remarks, we hope they're completely in harmony with our study in Volume 2, so we're just going to summarize it rather briefly. In ancient culture, in the ancient culture of Israel, God set up two basic kinds of Sabbaths. We're going to call the one the lesser Sabbath. We call the other one the greater Sabbath. The lesser Sabbath pictures what will happen in the greater Sabbath, as we've just looked at, five dimensions. But also the lesser Sabbath must be used to determine when the greater Sabbath begins. And God gives us two examples because he doesn't want us to miss the point. Let's take a look at both the relationship between the Sabbath day and the Jubilee day, the one being the lesser, the other being the greater. But both of these are day Sabbaths. In Exodus chapter 31, verse 15, we read that every seventh day of the week is a Sabbath, Sabbath of rest. Every 7 days, every Saturday is a Sabbath to the Jew. No work. Leviticus 23, verses 15 and 16, we see that God does something with this Sabbath every seventh day. In Leviticus 23, we read that the seventh day multiplied or squared, seventh day times 7 weeks or cycles gives us 49, and the following is the 50th day. That was the day of Pentecost. So God here is showing us that he is squaring the lesser Sabbath cycle in order to determine when the greater Sabbath begins. Let's look at a second example, because again, God doesn't want us to miss the point. We're looking at both the Sabbath year and the Jubilee year, and how those relate to each other. In Leviticus chapter 25, verses 1 to 4, we find there that every seventh year from the time that Israel set foot in Eretz Israel was a Sabbath year. Every seventh year. In Leviticus 25, verses 8 to 10, we read that this seventh year multiplied by seven cycles gives us 49 years. The following year, the 50th, was the Jubilee year. So we see that the lesser Sabbath, the every seven-year Sabbath, was used to calculate when the greater Sabbath, the Jubilee year, would actually begin. So God here we see on both a day level as well as a year level, he has established a pattern. He's established a time pattern. Square the lesser to determine when the greater begins. So relative to Peter's Jubilee, Moses' Jubilee is the lesser Sabbath. Peter's jubilee is the greater Sabbath, the 50-year cycle. So by squaring Moses' lesser Sabbath of 50 years, that gives us Peter's grand cycle of 2,500 years. So 2,500 years is the length of the measuring stick, if you will, that gets us from Moses' jubilee to Peter's jubilee. The only question is, when do we start measuring the 2,500? Jesus gives us the answer in the text that we already read, Matthew 5:18. And from Matthew 5:18, we learn a very simple concept. When the type ceases, the antitype begins. So when Moses' restitution stopped, Peter's restitution started. Israel set foot in the Promised Land in October 1576 B.C., as we learned in our chronology studies. In 19 jubilees plus 19 years later, Judah was carried off to Babylon for 70 years. No more jubilees. The cycle was broken because 70 is longer than 50. So the cycle stopped after 19 jubilees. So if we measure 2,500 from 626, we arrive at October 1875. A.D. You say, well, that's 1 year off. And that's true. But there's something here, remember, that Brother Russell teaches us in Volume 2. He says, since we are reaching for the antitype, the 2,500th year is part of the antitype. And the antitype is 1,000 years. So the 2,500th year is replaced by 1,000 years. And so Peter's 1,000-year times of restitution begin in October of 1874. Now, October 1874 is very important to each of us. And again, God doesn't want us to miss the point. So he gave us a second witness on how we reach that date. He gave us a prophetic witness. In addition to the law witness, he gives us a witness from the prophecies, or a prophetic witness. God desolated, when the nation of Israel was carried off to Babylon, the land was desolated for 70 years, beginning with Zedekiah's overthrow in 606 B.C. 606 to 536, 70 years. Why 70? Well, we read in 2 Chronicles 36:21, to fulfill 70 Sabbath years. And we believe it's talking about the chief Sabbath years. What were the 70 chief Sabbath? What was the chiefest of the Sabbath years that Israel identified or marked or celebrated? It was the Jubilee years. So 2 Chronicles 36:21 was to fulfill 70 Jubilee Sabbaths perfectly. So God designed that 70 of Moses' Jubilee cycles would measure the time between the time that Israel entered the Promised Land and the beginning of Peter's Jubilee. So the length of the time from entering the land to Peter's Jubilee was 3,449 years. Why 3,449 and not 3,500? Because the first 19 Jubilees had 50 years, and the remaining 51 had only 49 years. So if you do the math, we find that 3,449 prophetic years measured from October 1576 B.C. gives us October 1874. Again, that's all hopefully consistent with the studies that we've already taken a look at in our Volume 2. But now we want to consider a supposed objection. You know, no study is complete if we reach a conclusion if we don't consider other points of view that others may have. So let's consider a supposed objection that some have raised about this conclusion that the times of restitution, Peter's Jubilee, began in October 1874. Since October 1874, an estimated 100 million people have been murdered, killed, maimed, and otherwise in an attempt to socialize the world. An estimated 60 to 80 million people, civilian and military, were killed in World War II. Over 6 million Jews, and reports currently, and perhaps you've seen them, is that it's much more than 6 million Jews perished in the Holocaust. Scientists estimate that over 150,000 people die every day. Friends, that's 50 million people are dying every year. During this one-hour discourse, over 6,000 people will die around the world. Since October 1874, the world has been plagued with disease and sickness and starvation. Since October 1874, we've seen the emergence of terrorism and counterterrorism. We've seen rampant and stubborn world poverty, illiteracy. We've seen the emergence of obesity. And in our society, we're struggling with alarming childhood obesity. We've seen environmental crises of all kinds, water shortages, pollution, erosion. Friends, the list goes on. We've seen criminal activity of all kinds seemingly going on unabated. Murders, drug abuses, the list goes on. In short, friends, since October 1874, evil has abounded in the world. There's no question about that. And so the question we should be asking ourselves is, isn't the prevalence of all this evil in the world, doesn't the presence of this evil soundly negate the suggestion or the conclusion that the times of restitution of all things began over 100 years ago? We answer no. World conditions does not militate against this conclusion. And we'd like to suggest two reasons why. The first is given to us by the Apostle Peter in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. 2 Peter 1:19. Peter says there, "We have also a more sure word of prophecy, whereunto ye do well that ye take heed, as unto a light that shineth in a dark place, until the day dawn and the day star arise in your hearts." Friends, in this text, Peter is reflecting on his Mount of Transfiguration experience. That's the context of this particular verse. And he's saying, I, Peter, firmly believe that God will establish his kingdom on the earth. I believe it because I saw it. I saw it in a vision. I saw the glorified Christ. I saw the glorified church. I saw the resurrected ancient worthies. I saw them. And I know the kingdom of God will be established. But you know, even though my vision of the kingdom was as clear and as bright as the noonday sun, there's something that eclipses my vision of the kingdom. Something more sure. The more sure, the most convincing, the convincing thing is the sure word of prophecy. The most convincing thing is the Bible. The most convincing thing is the revealed word of God. The more sure word of prophecy transcends any observations that we might make. The word of God transcends any preconceived notions of what the beginning of the times of restitution should look like, or what we think they should look like. These transcend. The sure word of prophecy transcends anything that we might think about relative to Peter's restitution. And the more sure word of prophecy comes down to the two texts that we've already mentioned, the two witnesses. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 18, which we've already mentioned, Jesus declared God's law that when the type stops, the antitype starts. It's that simple. There's no gap in between. Israel stopped celebrating Jubilees in 626 B.C., and something critical happened then. And Jesus assures us that the antitype then and there began, and one grand cycle later is 1874. Also, God through Moses said in 2 Chronicles 36:21, which we've already looked at and read, that there will be 70 Jubilee cycles. And these extend from the time that Israel entered the promised land and the times of restitution of all things. As we've already learned, the Israelites entered their land in 1576 BC, a simple 70 cycles later, It's October 1874. That's the sure word of prophecy that Peter talks about in 2 Peter 1:19. Friends, any preconceived notions we have about the times of restitution of all things must yield to what the Bible teaches. No matter how dark and evil the world looks, that does not negate the Bible. The Bible represents the only point of view that matters. And whose point of view is that? It's God's point of view. And that's the only one that matters. And that's the one that we want to get inside of our heads as best we can. You know, Paul said it so well in Romans chapter 3, verse 4. Romans 3, 4, where he said, "Let God be true, though it prove every man a liar." God's point of view is the only one that counts. Let's consider a second reason why evil in the world does not negate the beginning of the times of restitution in 1874. We turn to Matthew 24 for this one. 24:45. "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give him meat in due season?" Now, the entire chapter of Matthew 24 is Jesus' answer to a very short question that the disciples asked. "Lord, how are we going to know when you return? How are we going to know when the second advent begins?" Jesus gave them a very long answer, didn't he, to a very short question. And he goes through world history. He goes through wars. He goes through church history. He goes through persecution. He goes through Israel's revival. He goes through the call of the new creation. He goes through the gospel harvest. He goes through all of these events that span a very long period of time. In Matthew 24, Jesus gave his disciples 2,000 years of history in advance within just a few-minute discourse. And then he says, in verses 42 and 44, he says, "Be alert." Jesus is telling his disciples, "Be alert. Be prepared. Because you're not going to know, specifically, the time of my arrival from the advanced history that I've told you." So Jesus is saying, all these things are going to happen, but with all these events I've just told you about, you're still not going to know exactly when I'm going to return. But let me tell you how you are going to know. Quite simply, I'm going to have my servant tell you. My special servant. I'm going to supply him with all my goods. I'm going to give him all essential truth. And part of the essential truth that I'm going to entrust him with will be the Jubilee Law and the Jubilee Prophecy. I will explain both of these to him. And that's how he'll know that I've returned. And that's the basis he'll use to tell you when I've returned. That's how you will know. In fact, this disclosure that I will make through my servant will be the only way that you know specifically when I will return. You know, the faithful and wise servant lived in the midst of global trouble. You know, it wasn't sugar and spice and everything nice back in his day, was it? Friends, just read volume 4 if we want to find out the condition of the world back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The world was a mess. Trouble, global trouble, chaos, war, conflict, evil. Friends, the list goes on. Yet this did not dissuade God's servant from declaring the beginning of the times of restitution in his day. When World War I broke out in 1914, the faithful and wise servant did not retract the truth he had published in 1889. He didn't go back and say, maybe this world war that just broke out, maybe it kind of looks like we made a big mistake here on declaring the times of restitution of all things having been begun. He didn't retract that truth. In fact, just the opposite. He declared that the terrible trouble, the terrible time of trouble, was a sign that the times of restitution of all things had indeed begun. It was confirmatory, and friends, we would invite you to take a look and read Overland Monthly, pages 84 to 88. One final thought for consideration. How do we understand God's viewpoint? Well, the times of restitution, as we've mentioned, is not single-dimensional. The times of restitution. Restitution itself is not an all-or-nothing concept. It has at least five dimensions. And all five dimensions don't begin at the same time. You know, the word times in the times of restitution comes from the Greek word chronos. And chronos means events. It's the series of events that make up time. Some of the dimensions of restitution have clearly not begun. Man's sin debt has not yet been paid. Man is still on death row, dying every day, as we mentioned. Man's personal liberty is not yet restored. He's still locked up in the prison house of death. Man's heart is still selfish, not yet reformed. But the new law covenant has not yet been inaugurated, which we believe is principally designed to reform the hearts of men. So where has restitution been happening since 1874? What is it that's been getting better? Anything? What is God's view? We believe the answer is in Leviticus 23:3. He says there, 6 days shalt thou work be done, but the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, a holy convocation. Ye shall do no work therein. It is the Sabbath of the Lord. Friends, no matter which of God's many Sabbaths he put in the scriptures for us, no matter which of his Sabbaths we consider, they all have two common threads: cessation of the normal activity and engaging in holy convocation with God. They both are there, both go together. God is saying on all these Shabbats, whether it's the Jubilee or any of the others, stop what you're doing, wake up, and start getting your thinking back in line with my thinking. This describes perfectly, we suggest, as to what's been happening gradually on a societal level since October 1874. This is being done through the increase of knowledge. This is being done through the sounding of the Jubilee trump of knowledge and liberty. For example, as a society, generally speaking, we no longer approve of the use of racial epithets. If you don't believe that, just go out and use one and see what happens to you. 100 years ago, it was funny. It's not funny anymore, is it? It's serious. As a global culture, we generally insist on eliminating environmental pollution. And friends, this is not just a U.S. point of view. This is a global point of view. The Earth Summit is an occasion that almost all the organized nations of Earth get together every few years. The whole world is now concerned about environmental pollution in social injustice and many other things. As a culture, we generally insist on protecting the lives of men and women in the workplace, just like God. Friends, we're not saying that mankind has become benevolent. We're not saying his heart has been reformed yet. No, there's still many rebels doing all kinds of evil. And we're not saying that all the laws that the governments of earth adopt agree with God's mind. We certainly don't agree, and God doesn't agree with gay marriage. And we're not saying that our government is going to bring in the kingdom. We're not saying any of those things. But what we are saying is, since October 1874, the Lord has exposed mankind to the evil consequences of his misbehavior. Mankind has responded to this enlightenment by adopting societal reforms on every level that you can think of. The Jubilee Trump. Through that Trump, the Lord has started eliminating man's old ways of thinking. God has started to break down man's old ways of thought. This dimension of restitution happens before Jesus applies his ransom merit, as we read in Harvest Gleanings, Volume 3, page 865, and Volume 2, page 197. These societal reforms are the precursor to the individual, personal restitution to be done under the new law covenant. Personal, individual return to God-likeness is a ransom work which we believe has not yet occurred. Friends, we leave you with the thoughts of the apostle in Romans 14:5. One man esteemeth one day above another. Another esteemeth every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind.